We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Hello, everybody. In 2007, Yashar Brooks published Flipping Out. Here we go. Myth or Fact, The Impact of the Year in Israel. And we wanted to bring together the gentleman responsible for this production this morning to talk about some of the issues that were raised in the book and try and take the discourse a little bit further. So with us this morning are the authors of the book, Rabbis Shalom Berger, Dan Jacobson, and Chaim Waxman. We're having some technical problems with Rabbi Dr. Waxman, and we're not sure if he's going to be able to come along for the discussion. But we are going to, and as well, of course, the publisher of the book, Rabbi Gil Student, who is in New York. Rabbis Berger and Jacobson are in Israel. I'm going to start this morning by directing a question to Shalom Berger. I want to talk first of all about the background of these students. In your section of the book, there are a number of allusions to a certain kind of almost diluted religious passion that the students experienced in their home context. And here's one anecdote, for instance, that you cite. Quote, "My father, who always went to shul on Shabbat, seemed more concerned with the social aspect of things. He ran the Kiddush Club at the end of Kriyat HaTorah, and never seemed concerned with the small things. He chose which of the three minyanim to go to on Yom Kippur based on which one had the longest break," unquote. So I guess my question to you is, do you feel that the year abroad actually reveals certain kinds of serious flaws in the intensity or the spiritual passion or the intellectual commitment of the mainstream modern Orthodox North American community, or perhaps that's too broad, maybe the New York North American community, because there was a kind of theme that ran through your section implicitly on that subject?
Okay, I'm on. I think my experience is that these kind of things existed always. I think it's true that the students perceive a certain lack of, should we call it, intensity in, for many students, in their, in the religion that they found at home. Many of them expressed this both from their own home experiences and synagogue experiences, as well as their experiences in high school. I'm not entirely positive that this is a real flaw in American Jewry. Every community has this kind of thing. I think it goes back to as I read history, every community had people who were more committed and less committed. Today in Israel, there is an entire movement, certainly in what's in the Dati Lumi community, in the national religious community, in which students are searching for some kind of personal meaning that they have found in Israel. It's called Chabakuk. Rav Nachman. Somehow we work into that, Rav Nachman and Rav Kook, which involves a search for spirituality, for singing, for dancing, or on some level a movement away from book learning and more towards experiential kinds of things. I'm not sure that it's an indictment of the American Jewish community. I think in certain ways it might be a sign of certain broader sociological kinds of things that are going on in the beginning of the 21st century or the end of the 20th century that some of these students are relating to.
Is there anybody else want to comment on that?
I think that this... Can you hear me? I think that this has been present in the American community, the Jewish community, for many years, and you could really see it in the beginnings of Torah Vadas, let's say the 30s and the 40s, when Rosh Raga Feivel Mendelovich was popular and there was a general leaning towards Hasidic attitudes that were more experiential. And you really see it throughout the generations or the decades that at least I'm familiar with, where younger kids maybe have been looking for something different that was more experiential than the book learning that they've been getting either at home or at yeshiva. And you still see today in the American community, let's say in Long Island, where the Ish Kodesh phenomenon is very popular, where you have a very charismatic and joyful davening and a rav that attracts a lot of people. I don't know necessarily that it's a failure of any particular educational system or religious system. I think maybe it's just a general reaction to the way you're brought up and looking for something different. Maybe the grass is greener on the other side, or just not every peg fits into every community, and different people have to find different ways to experience Judaism.
I'll speak to that, but from a slightly different angle. Can you hear me? Speaking not from my own perspective, but from the perspective of the students who've gone through the year, I think what Sholem and Gil said has merit to it, but certainly from the point of view of students, not all students, but the students that people are noticing most when they talk about the year in Israel and flipping out, students who are really going through change while they're in Israel, those students certainly initially, and to some extent in continuing through the years, they certainly perceive the changes that they're going through as in large part a reaction to what they do see as deficiencies. To some extent that's normal, as I think Gil's alluding to, that's normal teen stuff, you know, rebellion and individuation as well. And a lot of that happens with non-Jewish students who are going off to university, who move in their own direction. I remember when I was in college in a seminar with a non-Jewish guy from a very WASPy background, describing how he, how the moment when he came out of the closet with his family, not what people think I'm saying, he came out of the closet because his family was Republican, and he told his parents he was becoming a Democrat. So to some degree, it's part of the teen years, but whether it's because of their own personal psychological teen stuff or because of an objectively correct religious indictment, certainly from the perspective of those students, what goes on in the year in Israel and the changes that take place are, to a large extent, a function of problems that they see with the communities from which they came.
Dan, if I can just follow up with you on that. In your section of the book, there's a very interesting point that gets made there. I don't know whether to be sort of troubled by it or encouraged by it. And that is that one student who was interviewed confessed that his observance during high school was, in his words, not ideal and, in fact, hypocritical. And he says, I didn't think of it as the right way to live Jewishly, but I felt it was the right way to live for myself in the context I was living in. I think I always had in mind that I would become more firm when I got back from Israel, and that was always in my mind. So what you have here is almost an a priori strategy that I'm not going to be so concerned about what I learn in high school, my Yiddishkeit when I'm a teenager in New York, because Israel will sort of firm me up. And it almost reminds me of the attitude that certain Israeli parents have about the army. You know, my adolescent kid is really wild, but the army will, like, take care of him and make a mensch out of him. In a sense, do you think that the year has become so successful that the day school system now counts on it, ironically, to compensate for our own lack of success in religiously motivating our youth?
I think there's a couple different angles within that, meaning the quote that you read, and there's another one in the book, another student coined a phrase that I liked. He said that he had himself on the pause button when he was at the end of high school. In other words, he knew something was going to happen. He was going to release it when he got to Israel, but the pause button was on. So one question is from the point of view of students, and that certainly... How widespread it is an open question, but there certainly are numbers of students in schools and communities where it's a near given that you're going to Israel, meaning there's many communities where that's not at all a given, but in those that where it is a given, there certainly are large numbers of students who have that sense somewhere in the back of their mind that whatever I do now is more or less okay because, you know, things will happen when I go to Israel. The issue of the high schools, I think, is related, but it's not the identical, you know, it's not the identical question. The fact that some of the students have that in mind doesn't inherently mean that their rabbeim are feeding that idea in there. Many of them are getting that idea from looking at older students or siblings who've gone through a process that they admire at some level, but don't feel ready for. I don't think it's a message that they're getting directly from their rabbeim or teachers in school, for the most part. But certainly, to some degree, I think, on the one hand, it's easy for those of us who are in Israel to critique those who are in the high schools, because look at what we do while the students are in Israel, and why couldn't they do that during the 12 years they had them over there? But, you know, as Newton and I guess others said about reaching great heights because we've stood on the shoulders of giants, the guys don't come in as blank screens that we're writing on. They come in with a lot that they've gotten from their rabbeim. I certainly have spoken to many rabbeim in high schools who feel that there's, and justifiably so, that there are certain things that they just can't do as well in the high school context, for multiple reasons, as can be done in Israel, and they do what they feel they can do, and then you know, to some degree rely on Israel to take things another step.
Can I just step in and address this to all of you? When you talk about there are things you just cannot do in high school, is it just that adolescence is turbulent and that it's inevitable that they may become more religiously serious in Israel because of a number of factors that the book talked about, because of a radical change in context, because of the intensity of the situation? Or is it also telling us that we need to change the way Jewish education is done in a certain level in the diaspora, at least in the modern Orthodox community? Maybe, Shalom, you can begin.
If I can share an anecdote, it was many years ago when I was a beginning teacher and I sat in on a Yeshiva University meeting of up-and-coming educators, and we talked about this very question. The question was raised, how come in Israel they can accomplish all these things that we can't do? And at the time, I expressed my feeling that it was the context. There were just the fact that students were in their home environment. They weren't quite ready to take on much beyond what was the norm of their community, that much. And you had to wait for Israel. And one of the more senior, someone who was a principal of the school, said, "So you're saying I'm a shomer kishuim? You're saying I'm just sitting there and watching, just guarding those cucumbers while they grow?" And I said, "It's not. There's no embarrassment in being a shomer kishuim. The work that you put into these students, preparing them for their experience beyond high school, is crucial. That's what makes it happen." And I think that as educators, we have to respect the fact that the end-all and the be-all is not going to be in our classrooms. It's going to be the kind of preparation that we give our students to mold themselves later on in life, perhaps after they've left our classroom. I'm very, very reluctant to indict the community of educators in North America today. I think that by and large, the teachers, and I was one of them, and I also had the great pleasure of receiving students from them when I taught in Israel. I think that many of them are working the Mesirut Nefesh and doing a wonderful job. Of course, there's always room for improvement, for innovation, and I think that today what goes on in classrooms probably is much beyond what went on 10 years ago, because there's just a need for it in so many different ways, whether because of technology, because of the way things have developed, images, social networking, all these things really have made a difference in our students' lives, and we have to be able to respond to them. Some of those very things are actually changing the way Israel programs work today, which I imagine is something we'll get to down the line.
Dan, did you want to say anything about that?
Sorry, me? I think there are some things that are happening in Israel, which Shalom's referring to, that are just not tenable during high school in North America or elsewhere. But there are some things that might be instructive. When I interviewed students for my dissertation years back, one of the questions I asked them, there are two questions I asked them. Number one was to describe inspirational moment during the year in Israel, which they were able to answer quite easily. And then I asked them to describe an inspirational moment while they're in high school. So that was interesting because a significant number of them paused and gave me a stunned look when I suggested that they might have had an inspirational experience during high school. But then when they stopped and thought about it, they remembered. Almost every single person was able to think of some inspiring religious experience that they had during high school. So there are things that are happening. At the same time, when I asked them about what the turning point was of the year, if they could put their finger, and obviously some students, the shift was more radical, and some the shift was more gradual over the course of the year, but almost across the board, even though they all described the sort of spiritual experiences, whether it was Yom Naram davening in the Beis Midrash, or going to the Kotel, or traveling somewhere in Israel, whatever it was, the experience that created some sort of switch in their religious identity was almost inevitably some form of conversation, whether it was one-on-one or a teacher, Rebbe, discussing something in Shir, not a Gemara, discussing some life philosophical kind of topic. And so it's something that doesn't, I think, happen as naturally in a high school context as it does in Israel, but finding time to incorporate both in classroom time, if possible, and also in more informal situations at a teacher's home, on a Shabbaton, et cetera, not just singing and kumzitz, et cetera, but one-on-one discussions or small group discussions about life and ruchnias, et cetera, are things that I think some high schools do. Some do more, some do less, but it's something that's a major aspect of what happens in Israel that won't be as powerful in high school, but could be something that will have an impact on a lot of students in high school as well.
It raises a question, and our listeners are actually thinking about this as well, is whether, you know, what happens if you don't go to Israel? You know, are we saying that the year in Israel is an essential part of preparing the next generation for a, you know, successful Jewish life? Because if so, as one of the listeners pointed out, that's a good litmus test for how effective high school is. You know, I mean, if you take away the year, are we now saying that these people really cannot be the Jews that, you know, we would wish them to be?
Well, I personally take interest in the question because I did not go to Israel for a year, although there's a long story behind that. So maybe I am one of the failures of the system, but I hope I'm not. But thinking back in my own personal experience, I'm looking at high school juniors and seniors, especially since when I was in YU, in Yeshiva University, I was in the first year shir. I chose to be there for my entire stay there because I had a connection with the Rebbe there. So I saw the first years coming in year after year, which was quite an interesting experience. Many of them as early admission right to freshman year of college. So I saw a lot of people before they went off to Israel, and then I saw them when they came back to YU after that. There are a lot of serious juniors and seniors in high school. There are a lot of serious first-year people in YU who did not go to Israel, and I find it hard to say that the high school system is failing them. Many of the success stories in Israel are kids who were very serious about learning in high school, and they went to Israel. And then in that year of dorming in that yeshiva-only environment, they they succeeded even more. So it's not really a failure, in my opinion, of the high school. It's just continuing that success. And I think of some of the rabbis I see now out in the field. Many of them were very, very serious in high school. And in YU or whatever yeshiva they went to, whether in Israel or in America, they just continue down their path. So I see that as a great success. Now, to one of the things that Dan was talking about, one of the reasons that one of the elements of the Israel experience is the dorm experience, which most high schools, not all, but most high schools don't have in the U.S., and that dorm experience allows more interaction late at night. For example, I'm thinking of one particularly talented student in YU who was at the time a sophomore in high school, but he was so talented they pushed him up to yeshiva-level shir. Now, he was probably one of the smartest and most motivated boys in the class. But let's say 12 o'clock at night, I was dorming in YU, so I could be in the base medrash. It's 12 o'clock at night. He was learning on a couch at his home, and that's a very different experience. And he didn't have that opportunity that I had late at night to interact with other boys in the yeshiva, interact with other rebbeim or older students, because he was on his parents' couch. Now, he was learning late at night because, I mean, he was very motivated, but it was just a very different experience. When he went to Israel, he had that experience. And then when he came back to YU, he also had that late-night base medrash experience because he was dorming. And I think that is a critical, you know, part of the puzzle, that dorm experience that allows you to interact with other people and to, you know, have that alone time and that personal time where you further the classroom experience.
I should say something about Gil, who related a personal story, is that the question was about kids who don't go to Israel to study, and Gil responded to talk about someone who goes to Yeshiva University. So first of all, I had assumed that the question wasn't really about students who choose to continue a yeshiva education, which is an environment that YU offers. There's also something else unique about Gil, that he was my student in the first school in ninth grade, which is probably something that affected him over the long term. But to go back to the original question, what about all those kids who finish high school and then go off to, let's say, to secular university campuses? Are they failures, so to speak, because they didn't have that year in Israel? Is it likely that their level of religious commitment or even commitment to Jewish peoplehood perhaps will be lacking? Here, I think the answer has to be yes. For all that many, many college campuses today, especially those that have large groups of day school graduates going to them, now have not only Hillels, but also many other kinds of support system for kids who want to daven with a minyan or certainly keep kashrut. From talking to my friends and peers who worked in those settings as rabbanim, it is not only the kids straight from high school, but even kids coming back from Israel. It is not a simple thing. To remain committed to the values of one's home and parents and religion in a setting that is not necessarily supportive of that. So Yeshiva University is very different, but in many of these places, no matter how good a job the high school does, the problems, the challenges that exist in settings where there isn't all that much support for religious growth and development, those challenges are there. That doesn't mean that there are kids who can't meet those challenges, but those challenges are there, and we have to recognize that.
I'll add just one thing. The first is we're entering the realm of the anecdotal, and Gil, I propose that you do your next study to clarify some of these issues about students who do not come to Israel and go off compared to those who do. Comparing those who are starting at similar religious levels. Obviously, those who go to Israel are more likely to be starting on a more religious level on the average than those who choose not to. But that's important research yet to be done. But anecdotally, for sure, as someone who was on, who went to college on a secular campus, anybody who has been, has seen. There are many who stay strong and many who drift off for a whole variety of reasons. And also when you look at the young men and women coming into yeshivas and seminaries in Israel, I think that any of the Rebbeim and teachers in the programs here in Israel could tell you that they could point at many, many students of theirs coming into the year who they could say depending on the institution, you know, in terms of who the student body is, but other than the top level yeshivas that take only the most serious students, in the typical average programs, Rebbeim teachers could point to many students coming in who would there's a strong likelihood that they would become not religious if they had not come to Israel for the year.
I think at this point it's worth talking about what we mean when we talk about success. You know, we're talking about kids, you know, Gil and Dan had a slight disagreement here about whether the kids are just going from good to better, which seemed to be Gil's implication, and Dan sort of added a different shade to it and said, well, there might be kids who really wouldn't be religious if they didn't go to Israel. But when we talk about the back end, meaning, you know, the seminaries of the yeshivot in Israel did a good job and they've come back firmer, whatever is entailed by that. One of the things that I was thinking about as I read the book is, what do we mean when we talk about success? Obviously, there's the clear, apparent level that you have kids who come back who are more committed to Shmirat and Mitzvot, Limudat Torah. Nobody can argue that these are wonderful things. I'm thinking, though, about the more nuanced issues. Do they get an experience that makes them, you know, thoughtful in a certain way? It's hard to describe this. It's a bit intangible. Philosophically thoughtful as Jews. Does it make them, you know, there are complaints that people have, and I guess I want you to address this, that they come back and they've sort of imported a kind of increased Haredization into their home communities, and that may be a positive, negative, or neutral thing. I don't have any judgment on that. That seems to be a perception, though, that people have of the people returning from Israel. So I guess I'd want you to comment on whether it's just as simple as they've come back, they're firmer, it's all good, or whether there are any troubling aspects to the way they return.
Shalom, you have to hold the transmit button. We can't hear you. You forgot to hit the transmit button, Shalom.
Thank you. So Elliot said no one can argue that coming back and being more committed to Shmirat Mitzvot is a good thing. Of course people can argue about that, and that's one of the positions that's taken up by sociologists who talk about this very thing, and how the modern Orthodox community looks nothing like it looked in the 1960s and 1970s, and what happened to the good old days when people could feel that we're all connected and we're all we can involve ourselves in the modern world and still be Orthodox Jews without any trouble. And in fact, there are kids who come back, and there these are issues that are raised for some people on disturbing issues as far as change in the community. I'm really sorry here that Chaim Waxman isn't on with us, because I think he has greater insight into the sociology of how these things work than do Dan, the psychologist, me, the educator, and Gil, the finance guy who publishes books. This is much more complicated than good or bad. There are certain sociological trends that take place all the time. The community is not the same. The American community in general and the Jewish community within it are not the same today as they were in the 1960s and 1970s. And on some level, the question becomes, in what direction are you moving? People point to the slide to the right, which is in fact the name of, sliding to the right is the name of Sam Heilman's book about this community. At the same time that I see a movement to the right, and by the way, he believes that the year in Israel is a significant part of that slide to the right, I also see all kinds of other developments in the community with regard to certain greater openness to, for example, a women's participation in synagogue ritual, which didn't exist in the past and whatnot. So I don't see this as a monolithic move of bringing a more Haredi approach to the community. I think that there are a lot of different things going on, and I think it's a very, very complicated issue.
If I could chime in here as the only American on the panel.
Yeah.
Dan, you want to talk for a minute?
No, just trying to hear you.
Go ahead, Gil.
Gil, can you raise your volume, please?
Sure. Is this better? Okay. I grew up in Teaneck in the 80s, and I moved out in 1990, but I've been back visiting regularly since then. So I have a bit of a perspective on how the community in Teaneck has changed, and it's changed dramatically over the past 18 years. And I think, again, this is my opinion. I have not done any studies. I'm just a publisher here. So, but my gut feeling is that there are many different factors, and part of it is the move to the right, the Haredization that happened. There are definitely kids, like Dan said. Dan and I haven't been arguing. I was just trying to emphasize that there are good kids who are successes who move on to further success, while there are also kids who weren't that from, who go to Israel and then become frumer. And many of them, or some of them really, and this was a key, I think this is important to emphasize to everybody here, a key finding of Shalom's study is that it's not a radical flipping out that is the main phenomenon here. It happens, but the main phenomenon is just a slight move. People become a little more careful about Shemiras HaMitzvot. They become a little more into learning and more dedicated to learning. It's not a radical flipping around and putting on a hat and becoming a Haredi. It's more just a more intensification of their religiosity. And if I'm saying it wrong, Shalom, please jump in. But what I've seen at Teaneck is a steady move to more dedication to more religiosity, which is not a bad thing, I don't think, although some people would disagree. But what we're going back to the point, why does this happen? Some of it is just more cosmopolitanism, if there's such a word, and that we don't live in a shtetl where everybody, you know, from birth to grave, we all live in the same place and follow the same customs and do exactly what our parents do. It's a more global era, and this is, we see it even more when we send kids off to Israel, and they're in a totally different community, and they change a little because they're in that community and bring some of that community back. It's just a lack of shtetlism. And here's the Gemara I was thinking about on Shabbos when I was thinking about this discussion. The Gemara in Tanis talks about Choni Hamagal, who fell asleep for 70 years, whatever that means, whether literally or not. He fell asleep for 70 years, then he wakes up, and he goes to the Beis Medrash, and he tries talking to people, and they don't understand him. And what I see there is just a change in the community. 70 years down the road, he wakes up to his grandchildren, and he doesn't recognize the community, and the community doesn't recognize him. And the point I saw there is that change happens. It happened in the time of the Gemara. It happened to our parents' generation. You think their parents were happy with how they came? You know, the crazy music, the loud music, and all the different things. Change happens in the community, and to some degree it's organic. And living in the modern global era that we do, it happens faster than it used to. But it happens, and you can't fight change. You can try, but you'll lose. All you can do is embrace it and maybe try to direct it and try to point in the right, you know, try to fine-tune it. But you can't fight change. It's going to happen when you send your kids off across the globe to another place. They're going to import back some of what they find there. And I think one of Chaim's examples was singing and davening before Kabbalah Shabbos, which has now become a pretty common practice, which was, I guess, imported, that Chaim says, from Israel by students who went there. And, you know, things change. The only advice I could give to anybody is get used to it.
I would agree with Gil from one angle and then disagree or want to take things in a little bit of a different direction as well. On the one hand, it's true. And there's something in the study of judgment and decision making called the vividness heuristic, which is that people will take note of something which is eye catching and perceive it as being much more common than it is. Shark attacks. People get nervous about shark attacks in the ocean. The likelihood of being attacked by a shark is infinitely small. So, but it's something when you see or hear about this image, it's so shocking and eye-catching that it becomes big in people's eyes. So the same is true, and I think is what Gil's going, is that when someone comes back from Israel looking radically different than they looked before, acting radically different, it makes a splash in the family for sure, but also in the community, and people notice it. So it appears to be a massive trend that's going on, and Gil's pointing out, you know, in the name of Shalom, that the bulk or the median is people who are going through more subtle changes. On the other hand, it's not just about a spectrum. It's to some degree can be looked at categorically, and this is what I found in the students that I spoke with, which is, there were some students went for the year who went through a growth process where they really came back. They felt they still belonged in their family. They felt a part of their family, a part of their shul. They still belonged, absolutely. They just felt they grew. They knew more Torah. They had become more spiritually deep, whatever it is, while they were in Israel. There were those at the other end who went through what people generally call flipping out, where they really went through what I compared to the conversion experience, not just Jewish converts, but any person who's converted to a new religion, really gone through a change in their goals and perspectives in life. And then there are those who are in between. Certainly in the second category, and it's a significant number of students as well. There are many, many people out there, maybe some of the people who are here listening and watching, who have, most of us know, either whether it's a child, a sibling, a nephew, a good friend's kid, whatever it is, somebody who went through a change like that. And that poses one challenge to the community. To my mind, the most interesting and challenging group is the group that's in between those two. Those who went through more than a growth process, they went through some qualitative changes, but not to the extent of feeling that they simply rejected the values of the community that they came from. And those people come back from Israel, and those are the people who are searching and trying to figure out how they fit, where they belong, and they're people that are sometimes misunderstood by the community, who might mistake them for those who have flipped out. But they're really looking for a place in the community. And that's a critical point to my mind, is the community being aware and figuring out how people who come back from Israel who've gone through changes can be not just looked at, and it makes some people nervous, parents and community members, looked at not just someone who's other and different now, but someone who maybe has grown and maybe become somewhat different, but still might have a place and a major contribution to make within the community.
Well, in a sense, what you just said goes back to a question I asked earlier about the whole issue with the context of the North American modern Orthodox community, and if there is a kind of diluted passion there, whether there will be tension when people come back with more commitments. I guess I want to just stay with the Israel side of things for a moment and ask you what you think is going on there. In terms of the changes they're making. One of the listeners, I think, asked an interesting question. Do you think that the Rebbeim and the Yeshivot in Israel see it as their role to increase the level of religiosity of these kids, or just to facilitate what happens organically to the kids? Although it's a strange dichotomy, because in a way the two are interactive.
I think that here you have to recognize that you can't talk about the Israel experience and answer a question about what the Rabbeim are trying to do. Every program is different. programs get different kinds of kids, and each of them has their own, I don't know, each of them has their own niche, but many of them have their own niche. Today, there are so many different programs that exist that it's really impossible to say what do the Rabbeim try to do. There certainly are places where the Rabbeim feel, and they say this outright to the students, whatever went on in your homes back in the old country that was that wasn't serious, there is no commitment there, and what we're teaching you is the truth. There, without question, are people saying that. Rest assured that in the days that I was in the classroom, that wasn't my message. I talked to students about their need to grow within the framework, within the misgeret that they were raised. And I talked to them, something that I believe in strongly, about the fact that their families are their, for most of them, for kids who grew up in committed families, are the foundation of who they are. And the foundation from which they have to see themselves growing rather than rejecting what they had. I think that what's really important is for parents to recognize that the programs are different, and for parents to play an active role in working with their children and making decisions about where they will study. The year in Israel is a powerful experience. And parents have to recognize that when you send your kids 6,000 miles away, even with emails and cell phones, living in a total situation in a dormitory with experiential kinds of things going on, their child will be impacted. And therefore, it becomes essential for a parent to ask that very question of the faculty, of the people in charge, and to make the right decision for themselves and for their children and for their family and for their community based on the answers that they get.
Can I just step in here for a minute? Because I want to ask, maybe Dan, you can answer this. And it's directly to what Shalom just said. Isn't there a bit of a strange, maybe ambivalence or double-edged thing going on with the parents of these kids? On the one hand, there's this feeling of, I want to send them to Israel, and I really would like the idea that they have a serious year of learning. And then, but there's also ambivalence if they come back, if they're quote-unquote too from. In other words, isn't this sort of trying to play both sides of the fence in a certain sense? You're happy that they go off to Israel, and you're actually happy that they get really committed to the learning, and you're happy about the religious observance. But then there's this kind of magical line, as long as you don't cross too far. And it's even hard to say what that too far is. So isn't it in a sense that the parents themselves really have to clarify for themselves their own vision? And isn't their vision really being tested out greatly by what's occurring with their children? Let's start with you, Shalom.
Okay, we appear to have lost Dan, so I'll try to respond to that. I think that without question, you're right, that parents want their kids to have that really, really intense experience, and then sometimes you get what you wish for. What a parent needs to do, and this is true across the board, having nothing to do with Israel programs also, but in general, communication within families is a really, really important and positive thing. Parents need to sit down at some point and sometimes hit their kids over their head with something that, without question, goes on a daily basis, perhaps in a less obvious kind of way, which is to share what are your core values. If a parent's core values include the centrality of Medinat Yisrael, so the kids will pick that up from the fact that they probably go to the Israel Day Parade or stand or make sure to dab in the shul where they say the Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina or something like that. But it's important to say that. But if you say to your kid, hey, one of the most important things to me is Medinat Yisrael, then, and you send your child to a yeshivat hezder where not that many American kids go because that's what's really important to you, then you can't be surprised if your child turns around and says, you know, I'm thinking very seriously about staying and doing hezder. If a family's core values are, and I'm not saying this is good or bad, every family has to make its own choices. As I read the comments here, so one of the comments that's going on is, well, is this good or bad? these aren't good or bad things. Every individual, every family, every community has to decide for themselves what's important to them. If your core value is to go and to get a higher education, that your child should get a higher education for whatever reason, either to be able to support their family or to be able to make serious contributions to the Jewish community or the larger communities, that's a measure that has to be shared with your child. If a parent doesn't share those values with their child and then wakes up one day and says, how is it that you didn't understand that I expected you to go to college? That shows a failure in preparation and perhaps a failure in making a decision about where to go. This goes back to the stories that still exist, although probably less in the Orthodox community, of parents who raise their children, don't give them Jewish education, and then say, how is it that you're marrying a non-Jewish boy or girl? How did this happen? And the kid says, well, you never did anything that made me understand that was important to you and to our family. Those kind of messages and communication are essential in general in families, and specifically with regard to the Israel experience, which has the potential to perhaps draw a child away from some of those core values if things don't play out in a way that we're prepared for.
I just want to reframe the question for Dan and Gil, because Dan was away for a bit. My question is whether parents are really trying to play both sides of the fence. They want their kids to go to Israel, become serious, committed Jews, as long as they don't cross a certain line. One of the listeners suggested the line may be a lack of interest in the secular world and college in general. I suppose other people would have other criteria for what the line is. But I'm wondering if parents really have to do a rethink about how they're looking at this entire year and the return of their child. Let's start with you, Dan.
Press the button, Dan.
Sorry about that. Is it true that parents are trying to, you know, whatever the phrase was, get it from both sides? Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a younger parent than some, but we all have fantasies of creating our children in our own image. And that means not too far this way, not too far that way. You know, anyone to my left is a heretic. Anyone to my right is a fanatic. So parents are entitled to that as well. But I think there's I have a number of thoughts about it. But I think that there are at times when parents make a mistake by simply not being sufficiently clued in about Israel, and Shalom was talking about this. I missed a piece of what Shalom said, so tell me if I missed something relevant to this. But a number of years ago, the Orthodox Caucus put out on the website, which I think now was taken over by YU, if I'm not mistaken, a format. Where Shalom wrote stuff as well, and included there was a listing of Israel programs where the programs got to describe themselves to parents, but they also have information from alumni telling the real story about what the yeshiva or seminary is like. And there's also a large new phenomenon, which I don't think existed a decade or two ago, of people in large numbers coming to visit programs. So that's one piece, is that parents and families now have the possibility of knowing what they're getting into in a way that they might not have in the past, and there's really no excuse at this juncture to go into the year in Israel without to be surprised at the end of the year at how one child turns out, if that's a typical or reasonably typical product of that yeshiva. In terms of parents, I do think it's critical, and I for that website, I wrote a handbook for parents, and one of the things I discussed there was that parents do need to rethink ahead of time, before they're sending their kids off, what their core messages are to their children, try to incorporate those things, whether it's at the Shabbos table and other situations, into discussions they have and to modeling for their kids. And the other part is that when their kids come back, there's inevitably when their child comes back and they've gone through changes during the course of the year in Israel, there'll be things that they approve of and things that they don't approve of. And it's similar to parenting in general. It's just a higher level and more complicated when you get to 18-year-olds or 19-year-olds instead of 8- or 9-year-olds. But people who teach parenting always teach that it's important to catch your child being good, which means not just to notice when your kid is, you know, opened, when your little kid opened the cereal cabinet and threw the cereal all over the floor, but to notice when they properly cleared their bowl off the table. And it's behaviorists tell us that it's a more powerful reinforcer to reinforce the good than it is to point out the bad. With young men and women coming back from Israel, part of the problem, what happens is that often parents notice what they perceive as the bad, the differences between them and their children, because those are the things that irk them and get under their skin, and sometimes unintentionally emphasize those. In other words, those are the topics that come up with their children, the battles, the discussions that come up too often, when in reality there are some things that are now different, and there are many things that are still very similar, and there are many values that came from the parents that the child is simply playing out in their own way. And to the extent that the parent is able to detect and notice the things that they admire and love about what their son or daughter has grown into in Israel, and to notice those things and to talk about those things, number one, the relationship itself will be better, and number two, the likelihood of that child feeling like they are similar to the parent. Part of it's in the perception. If the child hears certain things from their parent, they will walk away with a feeling that I changed in Israel, but you know what? I'm still very similar to my parents. Well, if the discussions over and over again are about the 20%, which are differences between the parent and child, they will walk away after a year or two home saying, wow, my parents and I have nothing in common.
Well, Mas, I think that's a good message to try and stress, you know, the points of continuity and the points of similarity. And one thing you said there that struck me that I think is profoundly true is that this is really an extension of something that takes place with parenting all along the school system, which is what happens when there is a kind of tension between a message that might happen in school and a message that might happen at home. You know, ideally, all of us want the educational messages that our children's teachers give to them to be in sync with the messages that we give them at home. But life being what it is, there's always going to be a kind of disparity at some point because of personality or just because of slightly different values or radically different values, because people send kids to schools for lots of different reasons. And I'm wondering how parents should negotiate that. Let's put this in really plain terms. If a rabbi at the school or a rabbi at the yeshiva in Israel gave a message that was, you know, radically opposed to the kid's message, the mashal, the rabbi in yeshiva says, really, I don't think you should go back to university. You know, I think that you have great potential as a Torah student, and you really shouldn't do that. And we know that the parents are very committed to the idea that the kid should go to university. How does the parent negotiate that? You know, how does the parent negotiate it such that they don't want their child to lose respect for the mentor, the teacher, but yet maintain a sense of their own values? Or as one of the listeners said, if a student wants to go to a more right-wing place than his parents desire, should they be allowed to force their child to go to the yeshiva of their choice? You know, that kind of thing.
I think there are multiple pieces to this. One piece is that the first question is how this happened. In other words, if this is something that's very important to the parents, how did their child end up in a place where this is what the child walks away with? That's a question. Now, my thinking on that was moderately rerooted when I was in the States last year, and I gave a couple of talks. A couple of talks while I was there that Gil arranged. So a parent came after one of the talks I gave, a couple, was after shul, and wanted to talk about their son. And it was this kind of situation where they felt the learning was great, but their child was just becoming more and more narrow and not wanting to go anymore where they wanted him to go to college, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And my first judgmental thought was, you know, didn't you know that that's the yeshiva where he went, where these things, it's not shocking that he's coming back with this. Why didn't you consider it? And as I was, you know, pondering whether that was something of any use to say as they were seeking some guidance, they said to me, and we knew ahead of time that this was a potential, you know, issue that could come up, but we supported our son going to this yeshiva anyway because it's a great place, the chevra is great, and we felt it was important to our son to be able to go with the chevra that he wanted, etc. So it's not always so simple as just telling parents, you just gotta be aware and, you know, take your head out of the sand and, you know, forewarned is forearmed. Be aware of it. Sometimes it's more complicated than that. So in those situations, I guess part of the question, Elliot, and a potential distinction is one can assume to some degree when a child is younger that the ultimate authority, even when a child is rebelling to some degree in teen years, that still the ultimate authority in that kid's life is their parent more than the teacher in school. One of the big questions that comes up with Israel is whether that's true when they come back from Israel, whether they still perceive their parent. One of the things that was interesting to me was that I found that I asked students about whose opinion of them was most important before they went to Israel, after they came back from Israel. And many, before Israel, almost all of them said my parents, after which some parents would probably find reassuring. But after they came back from Israel, many said, this and this Rebbe in the yeshiva, teacher in the yeshiva, but almost all of them said the teacher and my parents. So parents sometimes feel marginalized, but in the large majority of cases where there was a healthy relationship with the parents before Israel, usually the parents, are still there, even if it doesn't feel like it, are still there. But discussing, practically, discussing these things with a 19-year-old is not the same as discussing them with a 15-year-old, and deciding to force your kid to go to a high school, that they don't want to go to is one thing. Forcing them to go to a college that they don't want to go to. It's not that it can't be done, and there are students who are forced by their parents to go somewhere and end up liking it and end up, you know, mellowing out a little bit if that's what their parents want. But there's a serious, serious danger that at this stage, if parents use real force rather than discussion and persuasion, there's a real possibility of ongoing and perhaps permanent damage in their relationship with their kids. But each case has its own nuances. And just one other point, I have a lot of other things to say, but I'm sure others do as well. So just one other thought about that, which is getting to know the Rebbeim in your student's yeshiva or seminary is a great thing. Many parents nowadays, some come before the year when they're checking out programs, but many come during the year to visit. It's common. And some parents come and they're excited about their what their child is doing in yeshiva or seminary, and they come and they sit in on shiurim or chavrusa and learn with their child. And there are others who go touring around, visit family, are in the hotel, and maybe stop by to say hello for 5 minutes. Chaval. It's unfortunate from all kinds of angles. They could benefit from spending some time in yeshiva. Their connection with their child will be deepened by spending time with them, and they potentially will also get to meet their child's Rebbeim. And if and when there's need after the fact, if there's a situation of tension where one of the teachers is saying one thing and the parents saying another, it's a very different kind of dynamic. If the parents know the teacher, know the Rebbe, and have some degree of relationship with the Rebbe, and the Rebbe knows them to some degree, to have a discussion and to continue that discussion and to figure out ways of working this out, it's very different than if the two sides don't know each other at all. It just becomes often much more of a tense, confrontational direction.
Those are words to the wise. That makes sense to me. Gil, did you want to say anything at this point?
I just wanted to emphasize something that Dan and Shalom point out in the book, and that's that we're dealing with 18 and 19 year old kids, and when they go off to college, let's say they didn't go to Israel and they went off to a college and dorm there, they would be changing, and I'm not sure how much an impact their parents would have on them either. People at that age, not only do they individuate, as Dan talks about, they are impacted by other. They grow up. They are impacted by other influences in college or in yeshiva. So it should not be too surprising that they come back a little different. And, you know, you should expect that. That's what happens as kids grow up. They're not going to be exactly like you, especially when they go off to live and to learn in a totally different environment. They're going to incorporate that into who they are. And you know, as a parent, I look forward to that with a little trepidation, but I look forward to that because you want them to grow up and to become, it's really good for the whole community. We want a community of people who are thinking about Judaism and thinking about who they are and where they fit in. I think that's only a benefit to everybody. Now, if it doesn't turn out exactly the way we want it to, you know, that's part of life. There is a shift to the right. That we've been having a lot of comments about shifting to the right, shifting to the left. There is a shift to the right. There's also a shift to the left. I mean, there is a polarization going on in the community that reflects broader cultural issues that I don't really think the book talks about too much, and I think it's a bit off the topic for what we're discussing. But there's a shift to the right and a shift to the left. You know, it goes hand in hand. What we'll, as parents and as educators, what we should be thinking about is, is it good for our kids to think about who they are and to accept influences beyond their local community? And I see it as, in general, a positive. And, you know, feel
free. Gil, we lost you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see Baruch Pelta has a from Miami has a very important comment that he just posted, and that's the book largely addresses modern Orthodox graduates of modern Orthodox high schools. That's very true, and there's a reason for that, and the reason is that the studies that Shalom and Dan did were on those groups of students. The book has actually been criticized by some as not answering every question and solving every problem, and there's a reason for that, and that's because for a study to do that, a real study, not just making stuff up like I do, but for actual professionals and you know, to do real statistical studies and surveys, you have to survey and study everybody. And that is a large goal, and it would be great if somebody could do that. But absent that, you know, what Shalom and Dan did was they did a study on a specific community, and they each did their own study, and they reported the results of the study and what we can learn from that. And I think the community has, to a large degree, learned a lot from their studies. And, you know, when we published it in a book, it was a few years after the studies had been done and published as doctoral dissertations. And it has had a great impact. And the point of...
No, we lost you again.
The book and really patients can benefit... I'm sorry, can you hear me? Okay, the benefit of the book is that people who don't go around digging for doctoral... dissertations, so Shalom and Dan did, and could have that... in, you know, influence their thinking and learn from it. Okay, Shalom didn't answer every single question that can be asked. He didn't address people who go from Tor V'Das to go for a year, people from Satmar schools to go to Switzerland for a year. You know, there are many different sub-communities within the Orthodox community, but their study does have a lot to tell us. And in that respect, you know, I don't think the criticisms of the book and of Shalom and Dan's studies were really on target. I'll just add one other thing. There was a criticism of their methodologies, and I'm not a professional statistician or a psychologist or an educator, but Shalom and Dan are, and their studies did get them doctoral doctoral titles. They got PhDs off of these studies. So I think it's kind of hard for someone with no experience like me to criticize their methodologies and how they did their studies.
Not to criticize the book, but just as a PhD myself, you should know that having doctor before your name isn't necessarily you can fill in the rest of the sentence. I wanted to ask a more macro question to all of you, and it has to do with something that I alluded to before, which is the idea of whether they come back not just firm in a sort of conventional sense, but thoughtful on the larger issues that maybe confront the Jewish world. You know, Gil, you said you can't fight change. I'm not sure I agree with you at all, or else we wouldn't all be here doing a Torah Motion program. But I wonder about the notion of Klal Yisrael here, and this is something that a number of the listeners have brought up as well. You know, are we training kids go to Israel, are we training them basically to come back and fit into certain kinds of boxes that we've set up in Orthodoxy? You know, maybe we expand the box a little bit to the right and so on. But I'm wondering about the kind of messages that they hear. And Sean, you alluded to this briefly, you know, where the rabbi might deride the home community of the students. I'd be curious, speaking of some names here, what those places are. But I guess I'm asking, you know, what kind of students are we creating? In other words, is our goal educationally just to make them fit into the structures we already have, you know, should learn Gemara and be serious in tefillah, and these are good things, of course, or are we missing out on something? You know, do we have an opportunity in a year in Israel to really do something more? Because you have time and space, and it's in a certain odd way, a kind of idyllic existence. You don't have to worry about, you know, money, responsibility, family, job. You're a student who's there, you're 19, 20, 18 years old, and I'm wondering if it isn't really a bit of a loss, a bit of a non-accomplishment to come back and say, okay, so I can learn more shas now. When there's really an opportunity to reflect on the deep issues that divide, say, Orthodoxy from other denominations, talk about what is the mission of Judaism, the philosophy of Judaism, etc. I know I'm probably not articulating this as specifically as you'd like, but I think you get the gist of it.
Turn on the transmit button, Shalom.
Okay. I think that you're right. I think that the many of these programs, again, not all, but many of these programs spend a lot more time dealing with ritual practice and very specific types of learning than with broader issues. And I do think that on some level, these programs have missed a tremendous opportunity. Of course, it's not over. Perhaps there are people listening here who can make a difference here. I think that some of the larger kinds of questions are questions that the yeshivot themselves are not willing to deal with. Someone who I spoke to recently who told me that he went from one yeshiva to the next and asked what the goals and aspirations of the yeshiva were told fairly openly. The aspiration was to get the kids to learn more Gemara, to get the kids to be more careful about mitzvot. But as far as broader issues about where the individual finds themselves within the Jewish people, those kind of issues very often are not dealt with, certainly not in an overt manner. The question becomes developmentally, and maybe Dan can talk more about this than more intelligently about this than I can, whether developmentally the kids who come are ready for those things. I would hope that they should be, or they should be encouraged in that direction. But as we live in a society where adolescence continues to older and older ages, the question becomes whether these young people are ready to deal with these kind of serious questions. Most of the yeshivot, I think, either because they don't feel they can deal with it or because they don't even realize it's an issue, largely avoid these kinds of things, and I'm inclined to agree with you, Elliot, that it is not to our advantage.
I think developmentally, I don't think that's the issue. I think they're at an age where they are ready, and I forget who it was before who made the deal. I think made the college analogy. There are students who are going off to college at 18 with and addressing all kinds of world, social, et cetera, kind of issues and leadership positions. In some cases, I think that's true because it's fundamentally just the hashkafa of the yeshiva. That's just the reality, and that's what we've talked about up till now, about understanding what the hashkafa of the yeshiva is when you choose it. But there are places where I think that hashkafically would tend to agree with you to some degree or another, Elliot. That would just explain this. It's a matter of intensity and focus. And in order, number one, with Gemara learning, in order to walk away from the year being able to learn Gemara at any decent kind of level, you can't be doing this and that and 500 things during the year. You got to focus on it. And concurrently with that, in terms of spirituality, although there are successes, as per Gil at the beginning, your average 18-year-old coming out of high school is not at the ultimate level of spiritual depth, and this is a year to focus on that. And there's a desire not to water that down by mixing in all kinds of other things, even if they are values. That said, I'll say, I mean, I won't use it as a form to advertise for my yeshiva, the yeshiva that I teach at, but it's one of the reasons that this yeshiva was opened, was because there was a sense that even though you need the intensity and the focus during the year, if you don't do something like chesed, for example, during the year in Israel, and it's your formative year, in your young adult life, what's the likelihood that someone spends the year or years in Israel focused solely on their learning, and then steps back to the States and continues to learn seriously, but then broadens out to think about community issues, et cetera, et cetera. There are many who do, but the odds are significantly lowered if it's not part of the Israel experience. One of the piece of the message, I think, to people out there, especially those who are in the States, is, and this relates to what Shlomo was just saying about extended adolescence, Eric Erickson talks about something they call moratorium, which is during this phase of life, of identity development, it's not something that happens overnight and then a person's set. A person tries on all kinds of different hats, and it's not hypocritical or anything else when a person tries on different things while they're in yeshiva for the year, and they're like this for a month, and then they're sort of like that, and they're, unless it's radical extremes, but it's a part of the normal developmental trajectory. And it doesn't end when they come back from Israel, and people don't always realize the extent to which the vast majority of students that I interviewed coming back from Israel, and after having been back for between 6 months and 2 years, the vast majority of them had not hit their final plateau in terms of identity development. I don't mean plateau in terms of not growing more, but in terms of who they were going to be, what community they were going to be a part of, what the core issues in their life were going to be that were going to be meaningful to them. They had developed a lot of it, but they were still bouncing things around, trying to figure out exactly who they were going to be. And for that reason, if when they come back, and this harks back to what I said before, if when they come back from Israel, the message that they get from the rabbi and shul, from their parents, from the other people in the community, is, we're so proud of what you've done in Israel. You've done incredible stuff, and you know a lot of Torah now, and you're dedicated, and you're wearing tzitzis, and you didn't before, or you're dressing more tzanua. I'm not saying people should comment to a random person in shul about it, but you're doing things, and we think it's admirable. And be involved in our shul. I'm thinking particularly a young man in the shul that I was assistant rabbi in the States, who came back and had, you know, frumed out or whatever in many ways, and but he became involved in as a his youth leader in the shul, and he contributed a ton. He was accepted by the shul, and he was welcomed, and he contributed a ton to the, you know, 8-10-year-old kids that he led. But also he gained, meaning he got the message that he still, even though he had felt he had changed a lot, that he was still part of the community. And the possibility with majority of students who've gone, even with whatever changes, they haven't utterly rejected the values they grew up with. And they're still percolating around. They're just not sure what to do with them. And if they get the message that they're still part of the community and there's value, what they've grown in is valued, then the likelihood of them taking interest in things that the community is involved with the broader Jewish community, with Zionist issues, et cetera, is, you know, infinitely increased, the possibility that that will, that part of them will continue.
I know that...
What are the takeaways? Ellie, if you don't mind. What are the takeaways from what Dan is saying? And this is a little repetitive, but I think it's a takeaway that we in the American community can take from his findings and from what he's saying now, is that in the local communities, maybe more can be done to harness these kids who just come back from Israel and to bring them into the community. I've seen in some places they have, you know, learning programs or other types of programs directed straight to these kids. Maybe we can do more than that to bring them into our community rather than to make them feel like outsiders, you know, whether it's local synagogues or yeshivas. One thing that I saw, which was a joke, a sad joke, in YU, was that every year at the beginning of school, you know, September time, Elul time, the Beis Medrash at night would be packed. Till midnight it was packed. You couldn't get a seat. And this was every single year in September. By the time October and November came around, it was maybe half as packed or less because people had burned out. They had come back from Israel and they had, there's a transition going on. And if somehow it could be, programs could be developed or mentorships or bringing them in so they can transition better into our community, we might not find however much of a negation and an opposition between the Israel experience and the U.S. experience.
Just gonna, thank you. We're just going to wrap it up in a few minutes. I had a couple of inquiries. One is one that I think maybe you don't want to cover, which is whether there was a difference in girls and boys. And I think you said explicitly in the book, certainly Dan did, that, you know, your study was really covering boys. So if nobody wants to answer that, that's fine. I'm just curious if there's a difference in what the messages the girls get, and also the reintegration is different because of perhaps shidduch issues, like, you know, pressure to get married. When they come back to the community, perhaps at a younger age than maybe the guys, whether you saw any significant differences in the year abroad for the female populace as opposed to the male populace. But if you don't want to cover that, just let me know.
I know that Dan specifically only talked to boys, and I really can't talk about reintegration that much. But boys and girls certainly have a different experience in Israel. I know this not only from my study, but I don't want to call this anecdotal. I taught in the men's program and in women's programs, and I found that both the expectations of the students as well as the schools and the faculty, in fact, were different. It could be this isn't unique to Israel. It could be that this is a general issue in Jewish education with regard to gender issues. I think that perhaps the simplest way I can point to a difference. I taught in a place where girls studied Gemara as well, so I was teaching both boys and girls Gemara in separate institutions at the same time. The boys wanted to figure out the Gemara. The girls wanted to figure out what meaning it had in their lives. This played out in all kinds of different kinds of ways. Perhaps Dan can talk about whether this is normal for gender differentiation. In general, the girls were more spiritual. They were more connected. They were more connected not just to Israel, but to the concept of Israel, to the experience of Israel, as opposed to boys who very often got got sort of hung up in the halachot about Israel. Look, you know, they're boys and they're girls, and eventually we hope that the boys are going to meet the girls, and the girls are going to meet the boys, and they're going to marry each other. When I taught in this, well, I guess I can say this, I taught in Midrash at Lindenbaum, also known as Bravender's, and at one point the girls were all worried about a shidduch because they were learning Gemara like the guys, and I was fortunate enough that year to have a young woman in my class, in my shiur, who was a college graduate, who said, yes, it's true, when you go back in your first year in college, the guys back from Israel won't date you because you went to Israel and you studied in Abravaners and you learned Gemara. But 3 years down the line, you're the ones who they're going to want to marry, which I think responds to other questions that have come up in the comment with regard to the question isn't only what happens when the kids come back, but what happens down the line. And I think that many of the issues and concerns with regard to, you know, so to speak, flipping out, really kids, even those who make serious changes, very often come back to the United States and find some level of equilibrium, both boys and girls.
I can't comment directly, but I'll raise a question based on what I was saying before, which is, in as much as I saw with the boys that there is a period of this moratorium going on for a matter of years, potentially, after coming back from Israel, it does raise the question, if the boys are typically not dating for a few years after they get back, that's one thing. If girls are coming back and starting to date within that couple of year period, if that moratorium period is somewhat similar on the female side as it is for the male side, it raises interesting questions because dating and making life choices when one is still in that period of flux, and there may be pressure to people, even if they're not quite sure who they are, where they're going to be, is a potential challenge.
So I want to thank all of you gentlemen for being here this morning, rabbis, students, Jacobson and Berger. I want to announce to everyone that in a few weeks we're just finalizing the date. I'm going to be conducting, in a similar format to this, an online interview with Rev. Nathan Kamenetsky, and we're going to be talking about his book and his life and the controversy that ensued after his book. So it should be a very thoughtful discussion, and I invite everybody to be online for that. You know, some of the issues that have come up this morning, talking about certain kinds of fragmentation within Orthodoxy. We're having a live conference here in Toronto on November 8th and 9th, in which we're going to discuss some of these issues. That conference will also be available online. We're going to have here Rabbi Yitzhak Adlerstein, Rabbi Michael Broyd, Rabbi Benny Lau, Dr. Tamar Ross, Rabbi Yehuda Gilad, and others as well. And a number of these issues we're going to get into in a sort of more intense way. Live. So I just wanted to allude to some of the upcoming programs that we have on Torah in Motion, and Jay, if you have anything to close with, I'll turn it over to you, but I want to wish everybody an Erev Tov in Israel and a good day in North America, and it was a pleasure being with you.
I want to thank Elliot, of course, for his wonderful job as always as a moderator. Flipping Out, Gil is showing Flipping Out. I guess you can order it at your Sharp Books. I sent the link out on my email the other day. We got it over here and there. Absolutely. Other books from your Sharp Books, and a pleasure having everybody. Really, like, thank you. And, you know, join us for our E-team. It's ongoing. We do update on the website. And as I mentioned, tomorrow night, Mark Shapiro is going to be starting his series Architects of Modern Orthodoxy, it's called, but he often does, like, people who would not be architects of modern Orthodoxy. Anyways, we have a Parsha class, a rotating Parsha class. Have a number of people from Israel who will be teaching. This is a wonderful opportunity to get people from Israel into North America. And I want to thank everybody, and I want to especially thank our speakers. And we apologize. I guess there has to be a little bit of a technical glitch. Chaim Lassman, you know, could not join us and add his perspective. But thank you, and go and read the book, and let's grow and learn from the experience, and hopefully to have kids who are well-adjusted and growing all in a religious way and all growing for the benefit of Klal Yisrael. Thank you, everybody, and Erev Tov, and have a good day.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.